Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 148. It's Monday, January 24th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, COVID-19 is still rolling over the nation. But the good news is it may be reaching its overall peak of cases and perhaps hospitalizations, but the death peak is more like a month away, as there are still tens of millions of new infections to come, and many of the most vulnerable regions in the country are getting to the worst of it, with higher proportions of unvaccinated and less healthcare capacity. In such a large and diverse country, with many regional epidemics rolling out, don't expect to see a sharp drop in hospitalizations and deaths overall in the nation as a whole anytime soon. We got weeks and weeks of that to come. Okay, well, while Omicron is having its way with us, there's some news, more news, on a substrain of Omicron called Stealth Omicron. This from the UK Daily Mail. Stealth Omicron, everything we know about new under-investigation COVID-19 strain BA.2. Health chiefs have revealed they are officially monitoring a new version of COVID-19, which has been nicknamed Stealth Omicron. The UK Health Security Agency has marked BA.2 a variant under investigation, which is one level below a variant of concern, after early data suggest it may be both more transmissible and better able to evade vaccines than previous strains of the killer virus. It is a sublineage of the original Omicron BA1, but appears to have certain differences that may make it faster at spreading and harder to detect. According to the World Health Organization, it is now probably outpacing the earlier strain, with some 8,000 cases identified in more than 40 countries, including the US, India, Germany, and Australia. Its stealth nickname comes from one of its key differences with the original Omicron. That variant was relatively easy to track because of a specific quirk. The deletion of a spike gene made it stand out on the widely used PCR test without the need for extra genome sequencing. But the new strain does not appear to have this feature, making it more difficult to monitor. It means that while PCR tests will still spot if someone has this version of COVID-19, the samples would need to be sent for further lab analysis to determine if someone had the stealth version. Dr. Tom Peacock, one of the first virologists to raise the alarm over Omicron, said, quote, "Even with slightly higher transmissibility, this absolutely is not a Delta to Omicron change. That said, I would not be surprised if BA.2 slowly replaces Omicron over the coming months with a slightly more optimized, mutations. The scientists from Imperial College London told the Daily Mail, "Very early observations from India and Denmark suggest there is no dramatic difference in severity." So more to come on that. But yikes, potentially even more transmissible and even more immune breakthrough?
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch. And I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, next up from Kaiser Health News, patient beware. Some states still pushing ineffective COVID antibody treatments. As the Omicron variant completes its sweep across the U.S., states with scarce supplies of monoclonal antibody therapies continue to use two treatments that federal health officials warn no longer work against the highly contagious version of the virus that causes COVID-19. Use of the newly ineffective treatments produced by Regeneron Pharmaceuticals and Eli Lilly and Company is highest in a dozen states, including Ohio. Many hospitals and clinics are still infusing the costly treatments, often charging hundreds of dollars a session, that public health officials now say are almost certainly useless. Well, one good treatment we have is the new antiviral, but this from Stat News says that may not be used as effectively as possible. Pharmacies shouldn't be the only place to get Paxlovid, the new COVID antiviral pill. We've been here before, the vaccines and earlier COVID-19 treatments. The difference, however, was that the federal government distributed other scarce therapies to state and territorial health departments, which distributed them to hospitals and clinics, which in turn determined which patients would receive them. Facing shortages, many hospitals developed allocation processes that identified the highest risk patients who were most likely to benefit from these therapies, based on things like vaccine status, immune suppression, and certain conditions that increase risk. They then tried to choose fairly among these individuals using approaches such as weighted lottery systems. These randomly selected among eligible patients, with some having better odds based on things like residence in a disadvantaged community, essential worker status, or pregnancy. Although there may be other fair ways to do this, the important thing about these approaches is that they aim to minimize giving advantages to the most well-off, well-connected, and well-informed patients. A decentralized pharmacy-based approach will result in a first-come, first-served allocation, which will benefit those who are already the most fortunate. Instead, states should allocate a significant supply of Paxlovid to their hospitals and health systems, which can more easily verify patient eligibility, check important drug interactions, and fairly distribute the medication. When the supply increases, pharmacies can play an important and expanded role, especially if they're able to offer both testing and prescription on-site. In the meantime, unless hospitals and healthcare systems are allowed to lead the allocation process, it will be left to doctors to carefully prescribe Paxlovid only for their patients at the very highest risk of severe COVID-19 outcomes. Once again, problematically, leaving public health solutions in the hands of individuals and asking them to make ethically challenging choices on their own. And again, doing that will decidedly give advantages to the most well-off, well-connected, and well-informed patients. Okay, well, in one interesting story from Medical Express, we're seeing one of the antiviral pills being made available to other parts of the world. More than 24 drug makers to make Merck's COVID-19 pill. A UN-backed organization announced that it has signed agreements with more than 24 generic drug makers to produce versions of Merck's COVID-19 pill to supply 105 developing countries. Molnupiravir has been reported to cut the hospitalization rate in half among patients with early signs of COVID-19. Actually, more accurate, that's about 30% reduction. Britain, the European Union, and the U.S. authorized its use in recent months. Of course, in the U.S., as in many other places, this Merck antiviral pill is not considered very effective and really is kind of an emergency use drug that's only supposed to be used when Pfizer's Paxlovid is not available, which currently is largely the case, but hopefully Paxlovid will be available a lot more in future months throughout this next year, and long term will be a really good addition. But to ramp up production of a marginal antiviral drug is really giving seconds to the second and third world. I don't consider this actually very good news. It seems like we should really be getting the Pfizer one jacked up if you want to actually have good clinical outcomes rather than just pumping more marginal drugs into people around the world. Well, and of course, this is news in a sense that we haven't seen very much of drug companies actually allowing their drugs to be produced by generic providers. To date, no coronavirus vaccine manufacturers have agreed to a similar deal. So in that sense, it's groundbreaking, but seconds for the second world. And of course, we have our own problems here in this country with a fragmented healthcare system. This from Kaiser Health News. Why Medicare doesn't pay for rapid at-home COVID tests? And I'll start off by saying that the reimbursements that are given that were required by insurance companies only covers 45% of the U.S. population that are covered by private insurance companies. There's a huge amount of people in this country that are covered by Medicare and Medicaid, which that doesn't apply to. So, what group is especially vulnerable to the ravages of COVID-19, even if fully vaccinated and boosted? Seniors. And who will have an especially tough time getting free at-home COVID tests under the Biden administration's plan? Yes, seniors. As of January 15, private insurers were required to cover the cost of 8 at-home rapid COVID tests each month for their members, for as long as the public health emergency lasts. Finding the test will be hard enough, but Medicare beneficiaries face an even bigger hurdle. The administration's new rule doesn't apply to them. It turns out that the laws governing traditional Medicare don't provide for coverage of self-administered diagnostic tests, which is precisely what the rapid antigen tests are, and precisely why they are an important tool for containing the pandemic. Medicare patients are left to seek free tests in other ways, including through the administration's new website, covidtests.gov, and at community centers. The Medicare program does cover rapid antigen or PCR testing done by a lab without charging beneficiaries, but there's a hitch. It's limited to one test per year unless someone has a doctor's order. However, about 4 in 10 Medicare beneficiaries are in Medicare Advantage managed care plans. These private plans may offer free at-home tests to members, but it's not required. Enrollees should check with their plans to see whether that's an option. Yes, folks, we live in a fragmented healthcare system. This is yet another call for universal healthcare, an actual national health program. We have a healthcare system that is neither healthy, caring, nor a system. And in another over-reliance on the private sector, this from Medical Express, COVID rapid test makers struggling to meet demand. Shortages of both supplies and workers are wreaking havoc on the efforts of COVID at-home test makers to deliver enough of the tests to Americans, even as the federal government pledges to provide 500 million free at-home kits. Like many other businesses, test kit manufacturers have too many of their staff out with COVID. Thus, even if they have the physical capacity for production, they don't have the staff. Mara Aspinall from Arizona State University and colleagues wrote in a newsletter. She estimated that the current total capacity, monthly capacity, of U.S. rapid at-home test kit manufacturing is 260 million units per month, which is expected to rise to 355 million by February and 526 million by March. The government's order for the free test kits is an addition to existing supply and doesn't interfere with existing orders, claims a senior White House official. I don't know how that exactly is possible, how it can't compete with it, but that's what they say. Supplies are also an issue. Demand for high-quality nitrocellulose membrane, the off-white fabric that forms the COVID test strip, has soared during the pandemic. In a statement, a spokesman for Millipore Sigma, a supplier of nitrocellulose to major U.S. rapid test kit makers, told NBC News that, quote, Raw material availability to make nitrocellulose membrane is readily available, but the world does not have enough membrane manufacturing capacity to turn the raw materials into finished goods, which are then used by our customers to manufacture rapid antigen tests. There's your supply chain issues, people. The company makes a product at a facility in Cork, Ireland. Although the company completed an expansion of the plant that doubled its capacity, even that did not meet the soaring demand. So this is another argument for why President Biden and even former President Trump should have used the Defense Production Act to ramp up testing capacity so we don't have these backlogs over 2 years into the pandemic. Of course, that article was both about stuff and about people. In other words, workers that were in the factories producing these things are out sick. And that's doubly true for the limits in healthcare. This from Stat News. It's staff, not stuff. Applying crisis standards of care to allocating healthcare workers. As the Omicron variant of COVID-19 rages across the country, healthcare workers who are already physically, mentally, and morally exhausted are facing a hidden crisis, having to make decisions at patients' bedsides about rationing healthcare. Political leaders and healthcare system administrators have left to them to make life or death decisions about how to allocate increasingly scarce resources, not least of all their own time and expertise. Leaders have long known that a prolonged pandemic was likely to produce severe shortages in supplies and staff. In anticipation of such a moment, guidance known as crisis standards of care have been developed. These are defined by the Institute of Medicine as a strategy to optimize the allocation of scarce medical resources and shift the moral burden of making decisions away from bedside clinicians to triage officers or others not directly involved in a patient's care. Although implicit in crisis standards of care, staff allocation is generally viewed as an operational issue. Many individual hospitals are already employing some crisis standard of care strategies, such as transferring patients to less overwhelmed hospitals, curtailing elective procedures, and developing algorithms to allocate medical equipment. The crisis standards of care are a framework that moves a continuum of care across three phases: conventional, to contingency, to crisis. The goal is to avoid moving into the crisis phase, but it's too late for that. As hospitals face yet another staff shortage due to the latest pandemic-related surge of patients, it is beyond time for governors and legislators across the country to put these strategies to use on a statewide level. Their failure to enact crisis standards of care has effectively abandoned clinicians at the point of care, forcing them to make decisions one patient at a time. Enacting crisis standards of care requires elected leaders to make the unwelcome declaration that the threshold of scarcity exists and that rationing of care is necessary. A statewide, coordinated effort to enact a consistent, equitable, and coordinated framework reduces the burden on individual hospitals and individual healthcare workers, creates legal protections, and proactively addresses inequities on a larger scale. The reality is that, because of the burgeoning healthcare worker staffing crisis, rationing care has already begun, but is simply hidden from public view. Most hospital staffing levels are calculated on razor-thin margins that make it difficult to absorb large influxes of patients. When a system is unprepared, the shift from focusing on the needs of individual patients to maximizing the benefits to the entire population requires bedside caregivers to assume the decision-making burden. Through no fault of their own, frontline clinicians are forced to limit the usual care and treatments they can provide to some patients for a greater benefit of others who are sicker. This reallocation occurs through delayed tests and procedures, missed medications, and deprioritized care practices that can lead to worse patient outcomes. Put simply, the most important resource for patient outcomes is trained and healthy staff, not stuff. And they are being allocated without the rigor that has been applied to scarce equipment, supplies, and treatments. The refrain, "there are no more beds," has become a common one these days. It's a misnomer, really. The healthcare system has plenty of beds. It's just running out of staff, nurses most of all. It's theoretically possible to make almost every patient room in a hospital into a mini intensive care space. It's just a room with a bed, wall suction, and lots of electrical outlets. But what the public doesn't know, and what hospitals and healthcare systems fail to acknowledge, is that with the onslaught of patients that the pandemic can bring, it's not the physical space that poses barriers to patient care. The problem is that hospitals don't have adequate numbers of trained nurses and other healthcare workers available to take care of sick patients. Bedside staff are a finite resource that cannot be expected to continue to compensate for systemic failures that predated the pandemic. Already exhausted clinicians are strained further. The volume of patients requires them either to turn sick people away from the emergency room and clinics, which they are loath to do, knowing that some of the lives lost could have been saved, or to take on more patients than they can safely handle. While a public health emergency requires adopting a population-focused ethical framework, it can leave clinicians feeling as if their professional value of first do no harm is violated. Moral injury and assault to one's moral core results either way. In a recent study, 38% of nurses and 32% of other clinicians overall reported clinically significant symptoms of moral injury. These compromises cut deep into the psyche of clinicians and are likely to result in more deaths, injuries, and illness. The path of least resistance for hospitals is to stretch their staff without adjusting for the consequences of asking staff to do more with less, even as these clinicians face the additional burden of deciding not only how to provide care, but also to whom. To add to the burden, they are also left with the responsibility of explaining these decisions to patients or their families. Many nurses and other clinicians being put in these situations feel betrayed by the leaders they trusted to create a safe practice environment and to provide guidance and leadership in crisis situations. The same investment of time and attention that was devoted to designing ethically grounded guidelines for allocation of ventilators, medicines, vaccines, and other treatments must now be turned toward the allocation and protection of human resources, specifically nurses as the largest segment of the healthcare workforce. And these new crisis standards of care must be implemented and evaluated to understand their impact. Implementing an ethical framework for human resource allocation is not merely an operations issue. It is an issue of fundamental respect for the humanity of patients, their families, and those who are delivering care. Allocation of human resources is not just a pandemic problem. It is fundamentally built into our healthcare, quote, system. The hidden crisis of bedside rationing was happening well before the pandemic, and clinicians were burning out before the pandemic for the same reasons they are today. Denying the reality of bedside rationing is not a sustainable coping strategy, nor is transferring the burden of adequate staffing to clinicians who have already sacrificed so much. We, as a society, must fundamentally rethink assumptions about what efficient and effective healthcare looks like. This reconceptualization would start with reducing the moral burden on healthcare workers during this pandemic. But it must continue afterward by peeling back blinders to the cost of a profit-based model for healthcare and addressing the value placed on rescue care versus preventive care. Maintaining the status quo increases the moral burden placed on clinicians and results in a less healthy population and more expensive care. We should aspire to a real healthcare system designed with the humanity of everyone in the forefront. Healthcare systems are unsustainable without a healthy workforce. The nation depends upon realizing the need for fair, equitable allocation of all types of resources in pandemic and non-pandemic times. How many healthcare workers have to leave their jobs or the profession before we take implementing crisis standards of care seriously? Okay, next up from Medical Express, good news about boosters. COVID boosters keep older Americans out of hospital, says CDC. The risk of hospitalization for COVID-19 among older Americans is far higher for those who are unvaccinated than those who are fully vaccinated and have a booster shot, new government data shows. The differences were stark. In December, unvaccinated people age 50 and older were 17 times more likely to be hospitalized with COVID than those who had completed the initial immunization series but hadn't yet received a booster, according to statistics published by the CDC. Among those aged 50 to 64, unvaccinated people were 44 more times likely to be hospitalized with COVID-19 than those who were fully vaccinated and had a booster shot, the data showed. The risk difference was even greater among seniors. Among Americans over 65, the chances of hospitalization for COVID-19 was 49 times higher for those who were unvaccinated than for those with the full vaccination and a booster. This is the first real-world data on the impact of COVID vaccine boosters in the United States and adds to research from other countries showing that boosters reduce the risk of severe illness and hospitalization, especially among older adults. Some good news. Okay, and some interesting news on the vaccine front. This from Medical Express. The placebo effect accounts for more than two-thirds of COVID-19 vaccine adverse events, researchers find. The placebo effect is a well-known phenomenon of a person's physical or mental health improving after taking a treatment with no pharmacological therapeutic benefit, a sugar pill, or a syringe full of saline, for example. While the exact biological, psychological, and genetic underpinnings of the placebo effect are not well understood, some theories point to expectations as the primary cause, and others argue that non-conscious factors embedded in the patient-physician relationship automatically turn down the volume of symptoms. Sometimes placebo effects can also harm. The so-called nocebo effect occurs when a person experiencing unpleasant side effects after taking a treatment with no pharmacological effects, the same sugar pill causing nausea or that syringe full of saline resulting in fatigue. In a new meta-analysis of randomized placebo-controlled COVID-19 vaccine trials, researchers at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center compared the rate of adverse events reported by participants who received the vaccines to the rates of adverse events reported by those who received a placebo injection containing no vaccine. While the scientists found significantly more trial participants who received the vaccine reported adverse events, nearly a third of participants who received the placebo also reported at least one adverse event, with headache and fatigue being the most common. The team's findings are published in JAMA Network Open. Nonspecific symptoms like headache and fatigue, which we have shown to be particularly nocebo sensitive, are listed among the most common adverse reactions following COVID-19 vaccination in many information leaflets, said senior author Ted Kapchuk, director of the program in placebo studies at Beth Israel and professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Evidence suggests that this sort of information may cause people to misattribute common daily background sensations as arising from the vaccine or cause anxiety and worry that make people hyper-alert to bodily feelings about adverse events. Yes, the placebo and nocebo effect. Very interesting. Okay, well, we know vaccines do work. It's nice to know that they don't provide as much actual harm in side effects as even expected from that earlier story I just did. But we have this from Bloomberg. Hundreds of millions of COVID vaccine doses risk going to waste. Some 240 million shots in the U.S. expire unused by March, report says. Health groups are pushing for more predictable donations. Hundreds of millions of COVID-19 vaccine doses purchased by wealthy countries are at risk of going to waste, a new analysis shows, while large parts of the world remain unprotected amid the spread of the Omicron variant. About 240 million doses purchased by the U.S., U.K., Canada, Japan, and the European Union are expected to go unused and expire by March, London-based analytics firm Airfinity Limited said in a report. The number of potentially wasted doses could climb to 500 million by that point if other countries receiving donated doses don't have enough time to administer them before they expire, it said. Okay, well, over the course of the pandemic, I've been reporting on COVID-19 in jails and prisons. We have a little update here, this from prisonpolicy.org. New data, the changes in prisons, jails, probation, and parole in the first year of the pandemic. Newly released data from 2020 show the impact of early pandemic correctional policy choices and what kind of change is possible under pressure. But the data also show how inadequate, uneven, and unsustained policy changes have been. Most have already been reversed. Prison, jail, and probation populations dropped dramatically from 2019 to 2020. But these drops were due to mainly to emergency responses to COVID-19, and correctional populations have already started rebounding towards pre-pandemic levels. Nationwide, states and federal government actually released fewer people from prison in 2020 than in 2019. The decrease in the incarcerated population was not related to releases, but rather to a 40% drop in prison admissions and a 16% drop in jail admissions. Deaths increased 46% in prisons from 2019 to 2020. And one little note is that when you die, you are considered released from prison. Even under the pressure of the pandemic, local jails held a larger share of unconvicted people than ever and continued to hold far too many people with low-level offenses and technical violations. State and federal policy responses to the threat of COVID-19 to incarcerated people varied widely, with a few states appearing to basically ignore the pandemic altogether. Okay, well, looking as a nation as a whole, we haven't done very well as far as COVID-19 policies for incarcerated populations. What was really advocated for early and was done in a small number of places was to actually release people to reduce the crowding to allow the potential to actually avoid infection in jails. But as this said, it was more inadvertent by courts being shut down and less people actually being incarcerated rather than actually going through and systematically seeing who can be released because of the different health concerns during the pandemic. Okay, well, while we're in the middle of one wave, this time the Omicron, it's good to step back a little bit and look at what the future may look like. Here's an interesting story from Science Daily. The newer COVID-19 variants now infect rodents, which often live in close proximity to humans. A team of biology researchers at Georgia State University has found that some of the newer variants of the virus that cause COVID-19 can infect the respiratory tract of wild mice, unlike the original strain that originally emerged from China. The study, published in the journal Viruses, found that the Alpha variant, first identified in the UK, and the Beta variant, first found in South Africa, were able to replicate in the lungs of wild mice, which the original version of the SARS-CoV-2 virus was not able to do. This evolution of the virus means that regular laboratory mice are now a useful model for researchers working to understand the virus, including the long-term effects suffered by many survivors, and to test possible treatments, said Mukesh Kumar, a virologist immunologist who led the study. So that's the good news. Kumar said the results also highlight the potential for the virus to replicate and mutate in rodents, which often live in close proximity to city dwellers. The virus is now able to infect animal species much easier than it used to be, Kumar said. So that does raise concerns about bats, rodents, and other wild animals. There may be another dangerous mutation that happens in animals and eventually jumps into humans. Researchers and veterinarians have found strains of the virus in white-tailed deer in several states, gorillas, big cats, hippos, and other animals in zoos, mink raised on farms in Europe, and a small number of pet cats and dogs. So this is a long-term problem because even if we were able to get COVID-19 down to very low levels in the human population, if you've got huge reservoirs of infection in animal populations, particularly those that are in close proximity to humans, this could be a reservoir for the development of mutations, new variants, and reinfection right back into the human population, potentially starting new epidemics. Okay, well, also looking to the future, this from Stat News. To get to a new normal, public health must focus on all respiratory viruses. Much of the response to COVID-19 to date has been reactionary. Travel restrictions were implemented after a new variant had already breached the country. The use of higher quality masks was recommended months after the emergence of increasingly more infectious variants, Alpha, Delta, then Omicron, and well after shortages had subsided. The need to ramp up the availability of rapid antigen tests was recognized during the sixth wave of COVID and amid the winter holidays. To reach a state of normalcy, leaders must look beyond the latest crisis and proactively prepare for an unknowable future, instituting policies and building programs that will guard against all respiratory viruses that pose threats to public health, society, and the economy. The nation must first agree on the goals of a new strategy. Many people had hoped that the SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19, could be, quote, defeated. But it's become increasingly clear, even to the most ardent supporters of a zero-COVID strategy, that this goal is now biologically impossible. By setting an impossibly high bar for success, public health leaders run real risks. They don't make optimal use of the highest yield interventions, they don't target strategies to protect the most high-risk and vulnerable people, and the nation loses trust in public health because our leaders fail to reach unattainable goals. Because of the measures to control SARS-CoV-2, such as vaccination, masking, improved indoor air ventilation and air filtration, testing and treatment, overlap with those to control other viral respiratory infections, we and our colleagues proposed in three viewpoints in the Journal of the American Medical Association, setting new goals for controlling all viral respiratory illnesses. We use history as our guide for where to set these new goals. During the century between 1919 and 2020, neither society nor the economy were shut down to control a virus. Yet, though illnesses caused by respiratory viruses are under-recognized and underappreciated, they are the cause of significant disease and death every year. In recent years, the U.S. has accepted as many as 35,000 hospitalizations and 3,000 deaths per week from influenza and respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, alone. We believe that hospitalizations and deaths are the appropriate metric for assessing control measures for respiratory viruses. Health systems can use projections to plan for year-round and seasonal hospital bed and workforce needs. Forecasts of hospitalizations and deaths linked to respiratory viruses could help public health officials and the general public plan for when to wear high-quality masks, switch to remote work or school, or avoid certain indoor activities, such as weather forecasts nudge people to carry umbrellas. The U.S. is currently averaging over 150,000 hospitalizations and 14,000 deaths per week just from COVID-19. That's four times as many hospitalizations and deaths as when influenza and RSV are in a bad year. Some think that suppressing hospitalizations and deaths to levels seen in bad pre-pandemic years is too ambitious. Some will be horrified the country didn't do more to suppress illnesses and deaths from viral respiratory infections in years past. But these numbers provide a place to start debating goals. Once the goals have been agreed upon, both national and local, the U.S. needs to build a comprehensive, representative testing and real-time reporting system for all illnesses caused by respiratory viruses. Every person in the country should have access to free testing and paid sick and family leave, empowering them to isolate when contagious and to seek prompt treatment. Rapid antigen tests, which exist not only for SARS-CoV-2 but also for influenza and RSV, and could be combined into one test strip for use at home. Labs, too, should routinely test for a panel of the most common respiratory infections in all patients presenting with relevant symptoms. Positive results from either home or lab-based tests should automatically link to treatment ranging from monoclonal antibodies to antivirals, as well as access to enrolled clinical trials. The U.S. government should accelerate the development and production of such therapies, making them widely available at low or no cost. Better measuring the burden of viral respiratory illness may lead to better understanding of what new antiviral therapeutics are most urgently needed and more closely link point-of-care diagnostics to appropriate treatments. An extra benefit of this approach would be reducing the overuse of antibiotics, which are effective only against bacterial infections, not viral ones. The country also needs to ramp up and target national genomic surveillance systems and reporting to better understand how viruses are changing over time, how they spread and cause disease, and how they evade immune and pharmaceutical defenses. Specifically, genetic sequencing should be conducted on a larger and more geographically represented proportion of respiratory infections, as well as breakthrough infections among vaccinated individuals, regardless of the severity of these infections. Results of all genomic sequencing should be uploaded into global databases in real time, facilitating a more global understanding of the emergence and spread of novel variants. Earlier recognition and characterization of new variants of respiratory viruses would allow state and local health departments and systems to mobilize resources proactively ahead of a surge and inform research and development on new vaccines and therapeutics. The most proactive way to stay ahead of future variants would be to develop a universal coronavirus vaccine that protects against known coronaviruses as well as oral, intranasal, and transdermal administered vaccines that improve both access and immune responses. Finally, the United States must strengthen its national, state, and community public health workforce to respond and serve effectively and visibly and to address both persistent problems and evolving emergencies. The COVID-19 crisis has created a unique opportunity for the U.S. to build a stronger, more proactive, and more prepared public health system. While vaccines will continue to be a crucial tool to control illness and death from viral respiratory infections, they must be complemented by a strong public health infrastructure. Real-time data, testing, treatment, air ventilation and filtration standards, and clearly guided non-pharmaceutical inventions such as masking and social distancing. By investing in a broad public health response that is both strategic and coordinated, the U.S. has an opportunity to build a foundation for establishing and returning to a, quote, new normal with COVID-19 and stemming future health emergencies altogether. That's a key to public health. Okay, well, it's time for the Lucas County COVID-19 update. So, I guess some good news in Lucas County is that we've had a drop in the number of cases identified from 916 a day down to 802. Of course, that's still one of the highest weeks during the entire pandemic, but it's going the right direction. And we saw a slight drop in the positivity rates. We finally fell under 25%, which is, of course, horrible, but at 22.7, that's better than 27.9% from the previous week. In Ohio and the U.S., both positivity rates are over 25%. Now, we're seeing slightly different trends in the U.S. as a whole. There's been a continued surge in the volume of testing. It's about double from 2 weeks ago. But in Ohio, in Lucas County, actually the volume has come down after a peak of a couple weeks ago. Okay, well, in nursing homes, we did have one additional death reported from long-term care facility residents, and we had a slight drop in the number of active cases in nursing homes from 136 down to 124, still very high, but a little bit interesting that is this is one of the first times that we've actually had more residents infected than staff. Not particularly a good sign. We had 65 residents with active COVID cases and 59 staff. So it seems that we might be moving through that stage of where staff bring it in and residents get infected, but it probably ain't over yet. Well, we didn't have any Lucas County school reporting last week, which would have been from a couple weeks, which would be the first week coming back. But now the reporting we have, yikes. In Lucas County schools, in the most recent week, had 221 staff with identified infections and 968 students. That's 3 to 4 times the highest amount that we've had previously. So that's a huge jump. In the state, there was over 4,000 staff and over 20,000 students that were infected. And that's more than double what the highest number of staff and students that we've seen infected statewide. So Omicron obviously is making the rounds. UT, we also saw an increase in identified cases from 144 to 166. Although a little bit of better news, last week their surveillance testing stuff was off the charts crazy, where we had a 14% positive, of the people that were randomly tested were positive. Well, it's down to 2.9%, which still isn't great, but it's definitely in the right direction. And hopefully that initial thing may have been some kind of aberration. It does happen. But it's up at you, University of Toledo. Okay, well, another good news, hospitalizations in both Lucas County and Ohio are edging down. Hopefully, be nice if this was a peak, but it looks like Lucas County is kind of hanging on a little bit more. We might have more of a plateau, and we'll see if Ohio can continue coming down or if it starts to plateau a bit too. Deaths nationally have risen to about 2,200 per day. This has been going up steadily and expect this to keep going up. The question is how high and for how long. Ohio deaths continue to set record highs and continue to increase. Vaccinations, both for those that have become newly fully vaccinated and got boosted, has gone up a little bit, but it's slowing down. It looks like we've reached the peak of people that are seeking out full vaccination or boosting. And looks like probably by the time we get through this Omicron wave, we'll probably have something on the order of 1/3 of the U.S. population that's actually been boosted, which many people are arguing should be the new definition for what fully vaccinated is. Well, folks, you are listening to 106.1 FM Toledo WAKT We Act Radio. This is just for the health of it, the People's School of Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's do a series of mental health stories. This from Medical Express first up. Suicidality is linked to risky driving behaviors in U.S. high school students. Two of the most common forms of death among adolescents are suicide and motor vehicle traffic accidents. A new study published in JAMA Pediatrics found that adolescents reported at least one suicide attempt within the last year. In comparison to those reporting no attempts, were more likely to also report infrequent seatbelt use and driving with a drunk driver. They were also over twice as likely to report drunk driving themselves. The findings from the study emphasize the need for mental health support for adolescents experiencing suicidality as a means of increasing safety for themselves and their communities, as accidental injury deaths via car accidents were the leading cause of death among adolescents in 2019, said lead author Kyle Ganson, assistant professor at the University of Toronto. The more severe the suicidality, the stronger the association with risky driving behaviors. Adolescents who reported a suicide injury, such as poisoning or overdose, needing to be treated by a medical professional, had the highest likelihood of reporting all four risky driving behaviors we examined. So another good example of the interrelation of public health problems. So suicidality, not surprising, it would be linked to people perhaps not either having drug or alcohol problems and driving while under the influence, or not caring perhaps whether they wear seatbelt or not. Okay, well, somewhat related news, this from the New York Times. Survey of Americans who attempted suicide find many aren't getting care. Suicide attempts in the United States have shown a substantial alarming increase over the last decade, but one number remained the same, the new study has found. Year in and year out, about 40% of people who had recently tried suicide said they were not receiving mental health services. The study, published in JAMA Psychiatry, traces a rise in the incidence of suicide attempts defined as self-reported attempts to kill oneself in the last 12 months, from 2008 to 2019. During that period, the incidence rose from 481 to 564 for every 100,000 adults. That's a 17% increase over that 9-year period. They found the largest increase in suicide attempts among women, young adults between 18 and 25, unmarried people, people with less education, and people who regularly use substances like alcohol or cannabis. Only one group, adults aged 50 to 64 years old, saw a significant decrease in suicide attempts during that time. Among the major findings was there was no significant change in the use of mental health services by people who had tried suicide, despite the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 and receding stigma around mental health care. Over the 11-year period, a steady rate of about 40% of people who tried suicide in the previous year said they were not receiving mental health care, said Greg Ree, an assistant professor of psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine and one of the authors of the study. The Affordable Care Act, which took effect fully in 2014, required all health plans to cover mental health and substance abuse services, and also sharply reduced the number of uninsured people in the U.S. from 14.7% of the population in 2008 to 8.6% of the population in 2020. Still, many respondents to the survey in the new report said the cost of mental health care was still prohibitive. Others said they were uncertain where to go for treatment or had no transportation. It is a huge public health problem, Dr. Ree said. We know that mental health care in the U.S. is really fragmented and complicated. We also know not everybody has equal access to mental health care, so it's somewhat not surprising. Since people who try suicide have a higher likelihood of making another attempt in the next 6 months compared to the general population, the barriers to treatment are particularly troubling, he said. Suicide is one of the top 10 leading causes of death in the U.S., with a yearly death toll that has risen 60% in recent decades to over 48,000 in 2018 from 29,000 in 1999. During that period, the rate of suicide in the population increased by 35%, dipping for the first time by 2% in 2019, according to the CDC. This has happened despite significant advances in brain science and the development of promising interventions using cognitive behavioral therapy, attachment-based family therapy, and dialectical behavioral therapy, said Dr. Christine Modier, the chief medical officer of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. One would argue, why haven't the rates been going down, she said. Until 2018, it's very clear that those treatments have yet to be made accessible to the general population. The study suggests that overall, people who attempt suicide face especially high barriers to access. Since the U.S. population as a whole is using mental health services at a higher level than ever before, with recent research suggesting that 1 in 4 Americans was receiving some care. This is not a new finding from that standpoint, but it is terribly concerning, said Dr. Modier, who was not involved in the study. The population of people who have tried suicide is distinct demographically from those who have died by suicide. While women make up a majority of suicide attempts, more than 3/4 of those who die by suicide are men, the data shows, among other reasons because men are more likely to use guns. The bottom line is, are treatments really work? That's one of the things that always surprises medical students doing psychiatry rotations, he said. But people have to be able to access care. When they can't, they're left with less choices. And for those looking for a quick technological fix in mental health, perhaps not. This from Stat News. What types of mental health apps actually work? A sweeping new analysis finds the data is sparse. This is a much longer article. I'll just give you kind of a conclusion. The Meta Review, published in PLOS Digital Health, examined 14 meta-analyses that focus specifically on randomized controlled trials for mental health interventions, including treatments for depression, anxiety, and smoking cessation. In total, the review included 145 trials that enrolled nearly 50,000 patients. The review found universal shortcomings in study design, leading the research to write that they, quote, failed to find convincing evidence in support of any mobile phone-based intervention on any outcome. Now, there's a lot of research happening this. Maybe we'll get better results in the future. Okay, well, one of the certainties in public health is that we will all die at one point. And this next story from Science Daily takes a look at the process of end of life care. And end of life care receives low grades even in many wealthier nations. Among the most troubling scenes from the COVID-19 era are the image of patients dying in isolation, unable to be with loved ones during their final moments. But even before the pandemic, harrowing deaths were all too common in most parts of the world, a new survey of end-of-life care shows. The study, detailed in three papers to be published in the Journal of Pain and Symptom Management, ranked 81 countries on how well their health systems provided for the physical and mental well-being of patients at the end of life. Only 6 countries earned a grade of A, while 36 earned Ds or Fs. Society should also be judged on how well people die, says Eric Finkelstein, a palliative care expert and professor at the Duke Global Health Institute, who led the study. Many individuals in both the developed and developing world die very badly, not at their place of choice, without dignity or compassion, with a limited understanding about their illness, after spending down much of their savings, and often with regret about their course of treatment. These things are very common. The United Kingdom earned the highest ranking in the study, followed by Ireland, Taiwan, Australia, South Korea, and Costa Rica, which all earned A grades. The United States earned a C, ranking 43rd of the 81 countries. There we go, in the bottom half again. At the bottom of the rankings, though, were 20 countries earning failing grades, many of which were low or middle-income countries with far fewer health resources than the top-rated countries. Perhaps the main conclusion from this important exercise is that most people in the world die badly, many through no treatment at all, and many through excessive, often futile treatment that increases suffering, says Richard Smith, a palliative care expert and former editor of the British Medical Journal. He and Finkelstein also serve on the Lancet Commission on the Value of Death, a global panel of palliative care experts who are expected to issue recommendations for improving end-of-life care later this year. It's no coincidence that most of the survey's top scorers are wealthy countries with well-funded health systems, while low- and middle-income countries fared worse, says Stephen Connor, executive director of the Worldwide Hospice Palliative Care Alliance and one of the study's co-authors. The overwhelming need for palliative care is in low- and middle-income countries, where less than a third of services exist, he notes. Both Connor and Finkelstein both point to the U.S.'s middling rank as proof that money doesn't always guarantee attention to end-of-life care. In the U.S., he says, resources are often invested in last-ditch efforts to extend life rather than measures to ensure comfort and quality of life in a patient's final days. We spend so much money trying to get people to live longer, but we don't spend enough money in helping people die better. The harrowing stories of COVID-19 deaths, when healthcare workers were often the only people allowed to comfort the dying, should bring renewed focus on end-of-life care. Generally, people don't talk about death. COVID has made it less taboo. We have an opportunity to continue the discussion and not just help COVID patients, but to help everyone have a better end-of-life experience. Finkelstein and colleagues hope the country's rankings spur action from policymakers to improve conditions for dying patients, such as loosening restrictions on pain medications given to comfort those at end of life. But people don't necessarily need to wait for policy changes to take steps to ensure a better end-of-life experience. Finkelstein says he advises people of any age or health condition to make an end-of-life plan and discuss it with families and friends. Do an advanced care plan, or at least express your wishes to friends and family, he says. Don't wait. By the time you fall ill, it may be too late, and folks may not know what you want. Okay, well, I want to end with a story, some hopefully a little bit better news. This from Health Day. Progress on lung cancer drives overall decline in U.S. cancer deaths. A new report offers hope on the lung cancer front. Patients are being diagnosed at an earlier stage in their disease and living longer due to better access to care, higher screening rates, and improved treatments. And that is driving overall cancer rates down, researchers discover. Of course, people not smoking helps a lot too. Still, lung cancer remains the leading cause of cancer death in the country, according to the annual cancer statistics report conducted by the American Cancer Society. In 2018, 28% of lung cancers were detected at a localized stage, compared with only 17% in 2004. Nearly one-third of lung patients now survive 3 years past diagnosis, compared to only 21% a decade ago. But lung cancer still causes 350 deaths a day, more than breast, prostate, and pancreatic cancers combined, and is responsible for the most cancer deaths by far, according to the report. Smoking is associated with 80% of lung cancer deaths, but there will be an estimated 20,700 deaths from lung cancer in 2022 that aren't linked with smoking. Sharp drops in lung cancer deaths fueled greater declines in overall U.S. cancer deaths from decreases of about 1% a year in the late 1990s to 1.5% a year during the 2000s and 2% a year from 2015 through 2019, the report found. The five-year survival rate for all cancers combined has increased from 49% in the mid-70s to 68% now. In 2022, the United States will have an estimated 1.9 million new cancer diagnoses, more than 609,000 cancer deaths. The lifetime probability of being diagnosed with invasive cancer is 40.2% for men and 38.5% for women. Along with the positive findings, the report noted a number of areas of concern. For example, cervical cancer is almost completely preventable, but more than 10 U.S. women die from the disease every day, and half of them are in their 50s or younger. Most of these women have never been screened, so this is low-hanging fruit, easily addressed by increasing access to screening and vaccination among underserved women. And while the overall prostate cancer rate is stable, the rate of advanced prostate cancer rose by 4-6% a year from 2014 through 2018, likely due to declines in the use of PSA testing, according to the report. It also found that the breast cancer rate has been rising by about 0.5% a year since the mid-2000s, and that there are continuing racial, socioeconomic, and regional disparities in rates of highly preventable cancers. Okay, well, that does it for the regular news reporting, and do have some bonus articles that you can read online, as well as the ones I just reported on. Links to the full articles. I'll give you the link after I'm done with these 10 bonus articles. The CDC's new challenge, grappling with imperfect science. 2, the real reason Americans aren't isolating. Many workers with COVID-19 still can't afford to isolate because they don't have paid sick leave. 3, how are private insurers covering at-home rapid COVID-19 tests? A hot mess. 4, plan for free N95 masks could save domestic mask makers or kill them, the businesses. 5, could a universal COVID-19 vaccine defeat every variant? Ooh, tantalizing prospects. Difficult task, but could be a very interesting good thing. 6, how a powerful company convinced Georgia to let it bury toxic waste in groundwater. Way to go, Georgia. 7, to skirt air pollution oversight, states can play hide-and-seek with poorly placed air monitors. 8, differences in how men and women perceive internal body signals could have implications for mental health. 9, we all need help working through grief and hardship. And last but not least, some good news. 10, 4 ways nature can protect your well-being during a pandemic. I've covered some of these before, but this is a good overview. So if you want to read any of these online, go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Again, that's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-